Hello, folks. I'd like to welcome you to the March 2016 edition of First Thursday. This is LRIS's monthly podcast on developments of interest in the field of public safety labor relations. My name is Will Aitchison, coming to you from Portland, Oregon, and I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or an hour or so. We've got a lot of things that I want to talk about this month, but I'd like to start with a question that was sent in to us. Some of you may know, we have a question and answer section on our webpage at LRIS.com. People send in questions from all over the country, and most of the time we'll try to answer them, giving the caveat, of course, that we're not giving legal advice. It's a pretty popular section of our webpage. Here, a question came in that actually we've been asked several times, so I thought it'd be worth talking about for just a minute on this podcast. Here's the question. Our department in Minnesota has an annual fitness assessment with no standards. If we are unable to take the assessment or any part of it, they are now asking us to explain the reasons why. They want to know about any injuries and attach supporting doctor documentation. Is this a HIPAA violation? Well, let's start with the actual question, and then I'm going to morph it into what I think the underlying issue really is here. Is this a HIPAA violation? What's HIPAA? HIPAA is actually an acronym for a federal statute that was passed in 1996 or so, and it stands for the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It was an early attempt at health insurance reform, and HIPAA actually contains a number of privacy provisions in it. And those privacy provisions we all encounter most commonly when we go to the doctor's office. They'll make us sign some sort of HIPAA waiver or something like that. Well, fact of the matter is, if you're looking at workplace implications, HIPAA really doesn't have an awful lot to say. I don't want to say it has nothing to do with the workplace, particularly the public safety workplace. There are some situations where you could see HIPAA coming into play. For example, EMTs that might be encountering medical situations out on the street. But I think it's safe to say that in terms of run-of-the-mill privacy rights attached to medical information in the workplace, HIPAA doesn't give us much in the way of protections. Where we find those protections are with a separate federal statute, the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I see the ADA coming into play in a couple of places with respect to this question that we got from Minnesota. So first of all, what's the medical privacy standard under the ADA? And I'm quoting pretty much from the statute here, what the ADA says is that the employer can get medical information from an employee if the employer meets two tests. First of all, it has to show that the medical information is job-related, and secondly, it has to show that it is consistent with business necessity. Those are very common standards in federal discrimination law. They're separate standards. Job-related, of course, means that the reason for something has to be related to the performance of the employee's job. And consistent with business necessity means the employer's got to have it. The employer can't do its essential functions, or at least that portion of the employer's essential functions that are being performed by the employee, without this information. So job-related, consistent with business necessity. Now, is the information that is characterized in this question from Minnesota, is this potentially covered by the ADA? Well, sure it is, because the employer is asking for information about injuries and is apparently requesting supporting doctor information. Okay, so it's covered by the ADA. Is the information job-related and consistent with business necessity? And to know that, we have to know what the fitness assessment is. Now, this question is kind of lovingly vague because it allows us to go either direction with the question. I like questions like that. This could be a fitness assessment where it's a health assessment Or it could be a fitness assessment that is a physical fitness test. Let's take the first of these two options, an annual health assessment. Well, in order for the employer to be getting information about injuries or doctor documentation, it has to show that the underlying health assessment itself is job-related and consistent with business necessity. And you can imagine, in the public safety world, you can imagine some health assessments that are and some health assessments that are not. So, for example, if an employer's annual physical health assessment includes, for example, information about whether or not the employee has a broken leg, well, that's going to be job-related to a police officer or firefighter's job, right? But if it instead includes information about, for example, blood pressure, it's kind of hard to say that blood pressure is related to the job of being a police officer or a firefighter or a corrections officer or whatever. So it's going to depend whether or not the employer can get this information from the employee is going to depend upon what the nature of the test is and whether the fitness assessment is job related, whether the employer can show that it is job related. And then, of course, assuming the employer meets that hurdle, it also has to show that the information, its need for the information, is consistent with business necessity. Well, let's go the other route. What if this is an annual physical fitness test? So it's a test that might involve whatever, push-ups, sit-ups, an aerobics test, any kind of annual physical fitness assessment. Well, here we have this same standard apply, job-related and consistent with business necessity, but for a slightly different reason. Annual physical fitness tests in public safety have been held repeatedly to discriminate against women. Now, there's nothing wrong with having a test that discriminates against women or any other protected class, nothing wrong, at least in a discrimination law sense. There's nothing wrong with having a discriminatory test if the employer can show that the test is job-related and consistent with business necessity. So, in other words, if the employer can show that its test is validated, if the elements of the test, whatever they might be, push-ups or sit-ups or whatever, if it can show that those elements are related to physical functions that the employee performs on the job and are a predictor of performance, then the employer might be able to meet the job-related test. Now, employers have failed that repeatedly, and they failed it. I didn't pick sit-ups and push-ups at random. They failed it even with tests that are as basic as sit-ups and push-ups because they had been unable to show that they have gone through what the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, calls the validation process. They have to show that these elements of a physical fitness test are in fact related to performance. And if the employer can meet that test, of course, then it has to show that the physical fitness test is consistent with business necessity. And here you have an entirely different set of public safety physical fitness tests that have been held to be illegal, that have been held to be discriminatory. And these are tests that are age and gender graded. You know these tests. They came out of the, once upon a time, they came out of the Cooper Institute in Dallas, Texas. They're usually you see them phrased in terms of a mile and a half run or the aerobics equivalent of a run, mile and a half run, which would be biking or walking or swimming. And for the longest time, those tests were age-related, age-graded. So you'd have bands, 20 to 30, 30 to 40, 40 to 50, and they were gender-graded. So you'd have different standards for men and different for women. And typically, the easiest standard to meet was the standard for a 40 to 50-year-old woman. So what's wrong with those tests? Why have courts held that those age and gender-graded tests violate Title VII of the Civil Rights Act? And the answer is, if you think about it, let's say that the passing standard for a 46-year-old woman is that she can pass if she runs a mile and a half in 18 minutes. How then can any stricter standard, any tougher standard, be consistent with business necessity? Aren't you saying to that 46-year-old woman who can run the mile and a half in 18 minutes, you can do the essential functions of the job of being a firefighter or police officer or whatever? Aren't you saying that? Then by definition, you can't have a stricter standard that meets an employer's business necessity. And so physical fitness tests in public safety have really been held, they've been taken to task recently under both the job-related and consistent with business necessity thresholds. Well, back to the Minnesota question. I finally got back to it. Let's say this question is about physical fitness tests, and someone says, hey, I can't do the physical fitness test. And the employer is saying, I want to know why, and I want to know the medical justification for it. Is that consistent with the law? And my take on it would be, depends on whether or not the physical fitness test itself is legal. If that physical fitness test does in fact relate to the job, the performance of the essential functions of the job, and if that test is consistent with business necessity, and the employee is saying, I have a physical condition where I cannot perform that test, then I think the employer can get the medical information. But if the physical fitness test doesn't meet those two standards, then the request for the medical information would probably violate the employee's privacy rights. So, long answer to what seemed like a simple question, but actually this whole area of getting medical information from employees and physical fitness tests, these areas, I mean, they're very hotly litigated right now. There's a whole bunch of cases holding that an employer cannot make routine requests for doctor's notes to verify the utilization of sick leave, that those requests violate the Americans with Disabilities Act. There's a lot of litigation in these areas. And if you have an employer, if you're dealing with an employer, or you are an employer, that makes routine requests for medical information, you need to be consulting the Americans with Disabilities Act. All right, let's move now to some actual case law out there. And we've got this absolutely wonderful case that comes to us out of California this month on what's known as effects bargaining. By the way, when I say something's a wonderful case, it's not because I like the, you know, the whether or not the employer won or the union won. When I say something's a wonderful case, it's because I love the way the court has set out whatever the particular doctrine of law is, and it's done it pretty well. So what is effects bargaining? Let's talk about all that. So if an employer wants to make a change in a past practice, there are three possibilities as to what can happen. And this is in a union environment. The first possibility is that the decision to make this change in a past practice involves a negotiable topic. You know, wages, hours, many working conditions are thought to be what are known as mandatorily negotiable topics. And if that's the case, then the employer has to negotiate about the decision. Is this change going to be made? And if so, what is the change going to look like? So, for example, if an employer is having recruitment problems and decides it wants to do a lateral entry program and start new employees at step three rather than step one, well, that's a change in wages. That's something where the employer would have to negotiate over the decision. Should that change be made? And if it should, how much? You know, should it be step three or step two or step four, you know, whatever it might be. So that's the first possibility, is that you have the decision that is negotiable. The second possibility is that the decision is completely non-negotiable. It's just a pure, flat-out management right. And, you know, that could be an awful lot of different things. It could be For example, let me take something absurd, but the color of police cars or fire cars. That would be a management right. That would be non-negotiable. The third category is in the middle, and it's where the employer has the ability to make the decision. That is a management right, but it involves negotiable impacts or effects on employees. And this is called effects bargaining. And so you see this very often in some states where the courts or labor boards have found that subcontracting is not mandatory for bargaining, but an employer still has to bargain over the effects of the subcontracting. Or perhaps the creation of a new classification, where the decision to create the classification might not be mandatory for bargaining, but the employer will have to bargain over effects such as wage rates and hours of work and things like that. All right, so that's our background here. Now, what has happened in this California case? This is a police case. It involves the El Dorado County Sheriff's Department, where the rank and file employees are represented by a union known as the El Dorado County Deputy Sheriff's Association. And in 2011, the county creates a new job classification known as Sheriff's Security Officer. The new job, the duties of the new job would be to provide perimeter security for courts. Now, the county, when it created the classification, put the classification not in the Deputy Sheriff's Association's bargaining unit, but put it in a general employee bargaining unit. And the reason why is this was more akin to a security guard job. The people who would hold this job would not have peace officer authority. And at the same time, the county deleted several positions, several job classifications, all of which were vacant, from the Deputy Sheriff's Association's bargaining unit. A year later, and there's no explanation for why this took a year, the union, the association, demanded to bargain over the decision to create the new classification and also over the effects of this decision. And the association actually had notice of the decision before it was implemented, but didn't demand a bargain until more than a year later. The county said, no, we're not to bargain. We don't have any obligation to bargain. You're untimely, because if a union wants to negotiate over a change in past practice, it has to make a timely demand to bargain. There's no bright line as to what timely is, but I can assure you it's not a year. So the employer is saying, we don't have to bargain with you. You've waived your right to bargain over the creation of this new classification and the deletion from your bargaining unit of these three or so existing classifications. And that's the dispute that ends up in the California Court of Appeals. And the court starts by saying something very important and very interesting. The court starts by saying, if an employer wants to make a change in a past practice where either the decision is negotiable or there are negotiable effects, the employer has to give the union notice of its intent to make the change. Now, in some states, the obligation to give notice is actually built into the collective bargaining statutes, but in most states, like in California, it is not. It is a creature of decisional law, court decisions and decisions from labor boards. And certainly that is the prevailing rule around the country. If an employer wants to make a change in past practice and there's either negotiable effects or the decision is negotiable, it's got to give notice. Then the second thing that the Court of Appeals in California has to deal with is, what does notice mean? Because in this case, the county gave the union notice that it was going to create this new classification. And it gave the union notice that it was going to delete the existing classifications. But what it didn't do was give the union notice as to whether the county thought there would be negotiable effects. So in other words, the employer just said, we're going to make this change. It didn't say, and we think elements of this change may be mandatory for bargaining. And the Court of Appeal said the employer did all it needed to do under the law. And here's the way the court puts this. The court says, when a union has actual notice of an intended change, together with adequate time to decide whether to demand bargaining before the final decision is made, the union will be deemed to have received adequate notice. And that notice, the court says, only has to be of the decision, not the reasonably foreseeable effects of this decision. Back to the court's words. Actual notice of a circumstance also apprises the recipient of foreseeable effects, especially when the recipient of notice is just as capable of perceiving the reasonable effects as the giver of the notice. In other words, everybody's presumed to be equally knowledgeable about the rights and obligations under the law. So, says the court, the county gave all the notice it was required to give, the union slept on its rights, and therefore there was no obligation to bargain under state law. But the court goes on. Because California has kind of an unusual system where you not only have a state collective bargaining law, in California it's known as the Meyer-Milius-Brown Act, you not only have a state collective bargaining law, you also have jurisdictions that bargain under that state law that have their own set of bargaining rules, labor relations rules. And sometimes those rules are in ordinances. And the law in California has been, for actually quite some time, that in addition to complying with whatever a state law is, employers have to comply with their own rules with respect to bargaining. And it turns out that the county had its own local labor relations rule that did require it to give specific notice to the association about the details of deleting job classifications from the association's bargaining unit. And so the court says, because the employer didn't comply with its own rules, it violated the state labor law's obligation to bargain in good faith. So what's the remedy? There you have a big issue. Is the county going to be forced to uncreate this new civilian kind of security guard position? Or what is going to happen? And what the court says is the only legally supportable remedy here is to invalidate the action that violated the local rule, the deletion of the law enforcement bargaining unit positions, and to require the county to, and I'm quoting, proceed according to law. In other words, go back, give the association notice, and then delete those classifications. The association was not able to win the right to attempt to get the new position put into its bargaining unit and was not able to get any back pay or any other remedies. Anyway, good effects bargaining case. That's the rule I'd expect to see anywhere. Employer has to give notice, and all the notice has to be is notice of the change rather than what the employer believes might be negotiable concerning the change. And what this does is it tells unions, hey, you just got to be prepared. Anytime you see a notice from an employer that it wants to make some sort of change in past practice, whether it's new rules that are being adopted, new ordinances that are being passed, whatever the form of the change might be, unions, you better be analyzing whether there's something mandatorily negotiable either about the change or the effects of the change. Now, I want to quickly turn to a lawsuit that's been filed in my backyard in Oregon This is a news article that I'm referring to. We'll send you the link to, or we'll post the link to it. This is a news article that comes out of a newspaper on the Oregon coast known as the Daily Historian. And the headline is Ex-Fire Chief Sues Over Firing. And it's the story of a fire chief in a small, gorgeous resort town known as Cannon Beach, who was fired, who turned around and filed a lawsuit seeking more than $500,000 in damages and reinstatement. He claims he was wrongly fired and also claims that the board of directors of the fire district defamed him in various ways. The part of the article that I found is most interesting. It wasn't the defamation piece. Defamation lawsuits by public employees are so rarely successful that they're really not worth talking about too much. But rather, it was the reason that the fire chief is alleging he was fired. He is saying, I wasn't fired because of my performance. I was fired because my wife made social media posts that were critical of the fire district board. So I just want to take this opportunity to kind of muse out loud about an issue that comes up from time to time, and that is, can a public employee be disciplined for his or her spouse's speech? In this case, a social media post, but it could be a speech. Now, let's assume, for the sake of this discussion, let's just strip everything down to the basics and assume this chief has no collective bargaining rights, no civil service rights, no contractual rights, no statutory protections. All this employee has is the Constitution. All this chief has is the Constitution as his bulwark against unjust termination. And let's assume as well that, in fact, he's right. He was fired for his wife's social media posts. Does that violate the First Amendment's free speech guarantees? Well, probably not, at least not his. I could see a claim for his wife, but not his, because First Amendment rights are personally held. And you can discipline somebody because somebody else made a social media post or engaged in a speech. Remember, we're assuming he has no contractual protections or anything like that. There's nothing unconstitutional about doing that, nothing that violates the First Amendment, at least. But might there be some other constitutional right that this could violate, disciplining you because of your spouse's speech? Well, maybe, and I think so. Courts have held that public employees have a right to privacy in their marital relationships, and that their employers don't have a right to impose regulations that improperly burden their marital relationships. And if, in fact, what you are doing is firing a fire chief because of what the person he's married to is saying, I think there's a constitutional claim there for impermissible burdening of the marital relationship. Now, of course, you do have to ask, why do we get there in the first place, right? Can it really be worth jeopardizing your spouse's at-will employment job to vent on Facebook? Although I probably don't need to ask that question, right? Because Facebook exists and employee spouses are going to do that. But this is a case, I just want to note it for you. I don't want to go any further than this. I'm going to keep paying attention to it. Hopefully it'll result in a reported court decision, and we'll figure out what the extent of the employee's rights are here if, in fact, he is able to prove that he was disciplined for the social media posts of his wife. Stay tuned. Now I want to turn to things disciplinary for a moment. Let's go all the way across the country to New Jersey. And talk about a case that raises a question that you hear asked an awful lot of times. And this is more of a law enforcement question. Most police sheriff manuals contain something in the code of conduct that obligates an employee to take appropriate action, some phrase like that, even if off duty, if they see a crime being committed. So what's appropriate action? Because this is a New Jersey case, I got to give you a little bit of background. New Jersey is unusual in terms of its system of disciplinary appeals. What's called by New Jersey courts as major discipline, which would be suspensions over 5 days in length, that doesn't go through the arbitration process. Instead, it goes through the court process, and a court appeal is a very difficult proposition for an employee under New Jersey law. There's a tremendous amount of deference that is given to employers, both in whether or not to discipline the employee and also what level of disciplinary sanction might be appropriate. So I must confess, when I read this case or started reading this case and saw it was a New Jersey discipline case, and I probably read, I don't know, 10 to 15 cases a day. And I just get used to seeing a New Jersey discipline case and thinking, oh, okay, employer's going to win. Not going to be anything terribly interesting discussed in the case other than the fact that the courts defer to the employer. That was my thought when I started reading this case. And then I read through it and I thought, whoa, this one actually is pretty interesting. So what goes on here? This involves a state trooper by the name of Michelle Garita. Hopefully that's the way you pronounce her name. And she was off duty in 2012 when she and her husband attended a country music concert. And it was at a place called the PNC Art Center, which is located across the road from one of the patrol's stations. And now, as the two parked their car, Garita saw a number of troopers who were patrolling the area. She secured her service weapon in her car because firearms aren't allowed inside the arena. And she had her badge in her purse along with her cell phone. So they go to the concert, they have a good time. And at about 11 o'clock, Garita and her husband begin walking back to their car along a roadway that leads from the center to the parking lots. And as they're walking, the couple encounter five men who were bikers. They were wearing motorcycle gear, that sort of stuff. Garita, who is 5 feet 4 inches tall, and her husband, by the way, is 6 foot 1 inch tall, each of the men were at least as tall, if not taller, than Garita's husband, and at least two of the men were stockier. The men began taunting Garita and her husband. They said things like Garita's husband didn't have a job and that they accused the couple, here comes the insult, get ready, that they bought their cowboy hats at a convenience store. The Garitas continue to walk away in an attempt to get away from these guys, and however, the men keep up with them. And then one of the men says to Garita's husband, tell your bitch wife to take the cutoff shorts home. And at that point, Garita's husband decides that they've crossed a line, tells the men, what you're doing is not right. And so one of the five men then punches Garita's husband in the head. He falls to the ground, and the fight is on. All five of the guys move in. They begin to kick and punch Garita's husband. Garita thinks there's a bunch of troopers in the area. I know, I saw them. She takes out her cell phone, calls 911 to report the assault and its location. And at the same time, she is shouting commands at the five biker guys. She's yelling things like, get off him, the troopers are on their way. After a little bit, and it sounds like the assault lasted maybe a couple of minutes. The men leave, get off of Garita's husband. They begin walking away, and the troopers show up. All of this within 1 to 2 minutes or so. Garita identifies herself to the troopers. She points out the men who attacked her husband. Eight other troopers respond to the scene. The men are arrested, and they're charged. And all is well and good until the patrol suspends Garita for 10 days. Why? Because of its rules that troopers were required, and I'm going to quote here, whether in uniform or not, to promptly report and take proper police action in any situation reasonably requiring such action. And how does the patrol fault Garita? They thought that she should have done more than she did. What is the something more? It's kind of unclear, but it appears that the patrol thinks she at least should have badged the assailants, if not jumped into the fight herself and tried to pull the men off of her husband. And this is the issue that goes to the equivalent of New Jersey's Court of Appeals. And the court begins by saying all the stuff you'd expect a New Jersey court to say about discipline. And that is, we defer tremendously to the patrol and disciplinary decisions and all that sort of stuff. And you think Garita's going to lose, and then the opinion does a 90-degree turn. The court says, look, we've got some problems with this rule. If a rule is ambiguous, and we think this one is, because we don't know what appropriate action is, if a rule is ambiguous, we are going to construe that rule in favor of the employee. And here, the patrol's only witness, the person responsible for the equivalent of IA, testified that it was in fact possible that Garita had done everything she could under the circumstances. She did, after all, call for backup. She did shout commands. There was a woman on the scene who Garita held at bay. That could have been all that was reasonably appropriate for her to do under the circumstances. And the court goes on to say, and I'm going to quote here, no patrol witness explained how or why proper police action required Garita to also identify herself as a trooper, show her badge, and then begin attempting to overpower the five men without a weapon, backup, or any means to restrain any of the assailants she might have been able to subdue during the 2 minutes that elapsed before the troopers arrived. In other words, says the court, Garita did what seems to be reasonable under the circumstances here. She took appropriate action. And so the court overturns the 10-day suspension. Well, what lessons do we learn from this case? And I think the most important one centers on the court's perception of the vagueness of the rule. And you see this happen with these sort of general rules, the appropriate action rules, like this one that applies to off-duty conduct and taking appropriate action to prevent or stop criminal behavior. There are other forms of appropriate action rules, right? There are some rules that require employees to take appropriate action when they see another employee violating the employer's rules. There are also other general rules, like conduct unbecoming rules, I guess is the most clear example of it. I think the biggest lesson here is when the employer hasn't specifically addressed what it is it wants the employee to do in its rules, that the rules will be construed in favor of the employee, that there's going to be a broad range of reasonableness that a court will say is what has to be brought to the situation. And if the employee's decision as to how to handle the situation is anywhere within that broad continuum, the employee will not be able to be disciplined. That's the problem with vague rules. Interesting case. Now, you don't see these come up too often, these failure to take appropriate action cases, and employers generally have a pretty rough road in these sorts of cases. Let's stay talking about discipline for a moment and go back over to California. There were just a slug of really interesting California cases this month. And this one involves California's Police Officers' Bill of Rights. California also has a Firefighter Bill of Rights that's very similar, not identical, but very similar to the Police Officers' Bill of Rights. And one of the provisions in the Bill of Rights says that a public safety officer who is being investigated, and I'm going to quote here, shall be informed of the nature of the investigation prior to any interrogation. That's a common phrase, right? It exists in many bills of rights and different places, not just statutory bills of rights, but also ones that appear in collective bargaining agreements. Well, what does that phrase prior to mean? How much prior to an interrogation must the employee be given the notice? And that's the situation that involved a police officer by the name of John Ellens, who's an officer, was an officer, for the Sierra Madre Police Department. And here's what happens in Ellens' case. As an officer, Ellens had access to what's known as the California Law Enforcement Telecommunications System. And that is a system that is a series of databases that allows officers to access information about criminal history and driver's license and vehicle registration, that sort of stuff. You know them. They exist in every state. In May of 2010, Ellens makes 12 inquiries of this system, and in the process accesses 43 different sub-databases. What's he asking about? He's asking about his ex-girlfriend and members of her family. He doesn't have any official reason to make those inquiries. The department finds out about Ellens' inquiries and opens an investigation after it receives a letter from, go figure, the ex-girlfriend, who reports that Ellens had told her that he had tracked her down with information from the database. This is defined as not helping yourself very much. The department decides it wants to go outside, hires a consultant to run the investigation, and there's talk back and forth. And finally, the consultant, Ellens, and Ellens' lawyer agrees that the interview is going to be held on October 13th, 2010. Just minutes before the interview was to begin, the consultant hands Ellens a notice of a particular charge that that said that in May 2010, Ellens was alleged to have improperly accessed the database. The consultant gives Ellens and his lawyer an hour to discuss the charges in private. Why an hour? Because that's the amount of time that the lawyer said he would need to talk with Ellens. However, after 25 minutes, Ellens comes out, tells the consultant, I'm not participating in the interview on the advice of my attorney. The consultant tracks down Ellens' commanding officer. The commanding officer appears, directly orders Ellens to participate in the interview. Ellens refuses. The department tries to reschedule the interview three more times. Ellens doesn't appear. He says he has medical reasons. And eventually, the department fires Ellens, citing not only the unauthorized use of the database, but also insubordination for failing to participate in the interview. And that gives rise to the lawsuit that ends up in the California Court of Appeals. And the question that the court has to answer is whether or not this notice given by the consultant, which allowed Ellens an hour of time to prepare for the interview, whether or not that notice was adequate, or phrased in terms of the Bill of Rights, whether or not that was sufficiently prior to the interrogation. And the court says, you know what, we're not going to draw a line in the sand here. We're not going to adopt a hard and fast rule. We're not going to say that it has to be one day of notice or 10 days of notice or whatever it might be. Instead, what we are going to adopt is a reasonableness standard. We hold, says the court, that the Bill of Rights requires an officer to be informed of the nature of the investigation reasonably prior to the interrogation, which means with enough time for the officer to meaningfully consult with any representative the officer wants to have present. The court goes on to say, look, you know, that could be different, and I'm quoting here, the time necessary to do so may depend on whether the officer has already retained a representative or needs time to secure one. It may depend upon the nature of the allegations, their complexity, and if the allegations are unrelated, the number of different allegations. We just can't say that there's any specific amount of time. Rather, we're going to apply a reasonableness standard. We think that's consistent with the intent of the legislature in adopting the Bill of Rights. Now, what about Ellen's? Did he have reasonable notice? Court says, yeah, because after all, the 1 hour was the amount of time that his attorney said was necessary to prepare for the interview. And then Ellen's didn't even take the full hour. He came out and said, I'm not going to answer the questions, well before the full hour was up. Ellen's rolled the dice, says the court, and he lost. The court upholds the termination. So this case, I think, is important for a couple of reasons. The first is the issue addressed in the court's opinion. What is reasonable notice? What sort of factors can be taken into account? And I think the court does a very good job of illustrating some of the things that might bear upon that question. How complex is the internal affairs investigation? How many different charges are there? That, I mean, all of that sort of stuff, those are the things you would expect to see in determining whether or not notice is adequate to allow the employee to prepare for the interrogation. So I think that's the first reason that this court's decision is important. The second thing that I take out of the court's opinion here is just a bit of advice that we have given in our seminars forever and ever. And that is, if you're ordered to answer a question in some sort of internal affairs interview, answer it. Don't test whether or not you've got some hypothetical right to not answer the question. Don't test that by looking at the possibility of an insubordination charge. The watch phrase that you see come out of hundreds and hundreds of arbitrators' opinions is, work now, grieve later. Comply with the order. And then if the order turns out to be an illegal one, file your lawsuit then and sort out your constitutional or statutory rights after the fact. Don't risk your job with a possible insubordination charge by refusing to answer questions. I want to leave you this month by talking a little bit about healthcare costs. We just have a document that's been released that I think is pretty helpful to everybody. It is the Siegel Consulting 2016 Health Plan Cost Trend Survey. Siegel, by the way, is one of the big players in the area of healthcare, and they have released this healthcare cost trend survey, for almost 20 years. I think this is the 19th year that Siegel has released it. And what they do is they make projections of where healthcare costs are going to be over the course of each year. And we'll put a link to the Siegel study on our website so you can go to it and get it. But just what's the bottom line? And what Siegel does is they break down their cost estimates on the basis of the type of plans. So you have HMOs, health maintenance organizations, you have what are known as PPO, preferred provider organizations, and they have two kinds of PPOs. So one kind is where you have to go to a primary care physician to get specialists. The other kind is where you don't. They also have high deductible plans. And then the last category they have are the very, very traditional fee-for-service indemnity plans that are increasingly rare in today's health insurance market. So I'm going to give you just the, I'll give you just two numbers. I don't need to give you a lot of numbers here. I'm going to give you the HMO number, and I'll also give you the PPO number where you have to go to a primary healthcare physician. Siegel is projecting that in 2016, HMOs will increase their rates by 6.8%. That's quite a bit more than the projected rate of inflation in the country, which is still hovering somewhere around 1%. Depends where you are in the country. West Coast is higher than 1% because of housing costs. But it's, so you can see a 6.8% number is, multiple, certainly, of the rate of inflation. For PPO plans, preferred provider organization plans, Siegel is projecting an 8% increase, 8.0%. And these projections are very much in line with what I've seen with other groups that make similar projections with respect to healthcare costs. So we're certainly looking at numbers that are much lower than we used to see before the Affordable Care Act. It looks like the overall, or one of the overall aims of the Affordable Care Act, which was to reduce healthcare costs, it looks like that is working, at least to some extent. But these are still high numbers. And when we're looking at 8% increases, that can be a substantial element of a total compensation package. Anyway, go to our webpage. You'll be able to find the link to the Siegel study. And that's it for our March 1st Thursday podcast. Look forward to seeing you sometime in the future. We've got a seminar coming up on collective bargaining for public safety employees in April of this year in Las Vegas. Should be a lot of fun. That is an absolutely great seminar that I very much enjoy. And if not, we will see you next month on First Thursday. This is Will Aitchison signing off.